insisting that it's doing an impeccable job protecting workers at nuclear power plants from COVID-19, especially during the current spate of refueling operations. But then you hear...
The refueling outage season in the spring involved the refueling of about 30 reactors across the country, starting in February, where you had workers showing up, say, at the Vogtle 1 reactor in Georgia, working that refueling outage for 2 or 3 weeks, and then moving on to the Sequoia reactor in Tennessee and working that refueling outage there. And you had the same thing happening in the Northeast and the Midwest and the Western U.S. with workers that were potentially picking up the virus at one site. And then while the pandemic was ramping up across the country, they were moving from reactor site to reactor site in these rural communities to where at the end of this refueling season, you get to Fermi. And all of a sudden, Fermi can't complete the refueling of its reactor because 15% of its workforce was infected with coronavirus.
Well, not only does Tim Judson, Executive Director of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, not agree with the nuclear industry's self-aggrandizing assessment of its COVID-19 worker protections, he's behind a letter detailing the problems, with footnotes, that has been sent to Vice President Mike Pence, COVID-19 Task Force Czar, with signatures from more than 80 groups that support the letter. It may not impress Pence at all, but when you understand what the problems really are during these COVID nuclear times, you begin to understand that there is no way out of that awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we are graced by two terrific interviews. In the first, Tim Judson, Executive Director of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, or NIRS, explains what's behind not one but two letters sent out by more than 80 activist groups to the highest reaches of government, spelling out COVID pandemic risks at nuclear reactors that put not only workers but entire communities in danger. Then we talk with Bob Alvarez. He is the former senior policy advisor to the Secretary and Deputy Assistant Secretary for National Security and the Environment during the Clinton administration. We'll get into the national and international impact of the current administration's withdrawal from international nuclear treaties and the simultaneous push to resume uranium mining and nuclear weapons manufacturing in this country. We'll also have more honest nuclear information than will be used by Hollywood showrunners under the new social distancing production guidelines. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, June 16, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. And it's all interviews this week. Here's the first of this week's two featured interviews. It's one thing to speak truth to power, but is anyone in power actually listening? That's what we now have a chance to find out. Tim Judson is Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, known generally as NIRS, where he leads the group's work on nuclear reactors and climate change issues, and has written a series of reports on nuclear bailouts and sustainable energy. Before that, Tim was chair of the board of Citizens Awareness Network, one of the lead organizations in the successful campaign to close the Vermont Yankee reactor. He was also co-founder of Alliance for a Green Economy in New York. Here, we discuss two major letters that have been sent on the COVID nuclear connection at U.S. reactors. And while the powers that be may have received them, We don't yet know the full extent, if there is one, of any response that they may have provoked. Tim Judson and I spoke on Friday, June 12, 2020.
Tim Judson, always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks, Libby.
We've gone over the issue of how the NRC and the nuclear industry are dealing with the COVID epidemic within nuclear power plants. Why don't you just give us a brief reprise of what is or is not happening on site at these nuclear reactors?
Sure. The honest answer is that we actually don't have any idea what's actually happening on reactor sites across the country, in large part because, or actually entirely because, the government doesn't require any reporting or instituting any standards for what the industry needs to do to protect its workers and to protect the public health and safety. What we do know is largely anecdotal, and it's almost entirely based on what a few owners of nuclear plants have said about what they're doing on their reactor sites. And frankly, it's hard to know what to trust, and it's hard to know how consistently things are being done and to what extent it's having any meaningful effect in terms of protecting workers. What we do know is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has essentially vacated the field of regulation on this issue. The NRC, from the earliest days of the pandemic, has essentially declared that it does not bear any responsibility for regulating the effect of the pandemic on reactor sites, except to enforce some baseline staffing standard that are required for control room operators, the small crew that runs a reactor at any given time, and the security force that have to guard these sites against infiltration and acts of malice. Aside from that, NRC has not taken any measures to mitigate the impact of the pandemic on reactor sites. It has allowed operators to decide completely on their own how they're going to deal with these issues. The NRC has also not taken any steps to mitigate the long-term safety impacts of the pandemic. As part of that, they've allowed potentially dozens of inspections and maintenance jobs to get postponed for potentially up to 2 years at these reactor sites, which is going to lead to what we believe is essentially sort of a hangover of nuclear safety risks that could span the period of this pandemic.
What does the industry say that they are doing to mitigate the dangers of COVID-19 on site at reactors?
They say things like they're practicing social distancing, that they're doing sanitation, that they're creating space within cafeterias where the workers, you know, eat lunch. They're taking temperatures of workers. They're encouraging workers to stay home if they get sick, that sort of thing. But what we're hearing from workers, which, you know, we're only hearing anecdotally because workers feel very afraid for their jobs if they speak out publicly on this issue, is that there's not nearly enough being done in terms of sanitation. There's been almost no personal protective equipment or PPE, that they feel very much at risk from the conditions that are existing on the sites. And in a number of cases where information has leaked out, we know that the rates of infection happening at reactor sites are far in excess of the rates of infection within the general population. I mean, take as a for instance, the Fermi 2 reactor just south of Detroit in Michigan, which was one of the last reactors this spring to shut down for a refueling outage, which is another area of concern I can talk about in a little bit. But the utility had brought 1,000 additional workers to the site for this refueling outage, number of contractors from out of state and from other communities. And by the time they got, you know, even halfway into this refueling outage, they had reports of over 300 workers testing positive for COVID-19. A 15% infection rate among the workforce at one nuclear power plant. The infection rates among the U.S. population are still down below 1%, essentially, you know, at least the official infection rates. And so what we see happening in the nuclear industry is that this virus is spreading and that nothing is being done systematically to protect workers against it. And because these are small, mostly small rural communities that don't have enough medical infrastructure to handle an outbreak of COVID-19 within, you know, the small resident population, the possibility for there to be hundreds of workers getting affected by COVID-19 and having to use the sparse medical capacity that these communities have presents a serious public health risk. that also needs to be mitigated. It's really going to require federal intervention for that to happen.
You also spoke about the refueling issue. Go over that one briefly just to review it for the listeners.
Sure. No, it's a really good point. I mean, there's, you know, the nuclear industry is a very small sector of the economy, and it's a very obscure sector of the economy. It deals with a type of technology that is very specific. Not many people understand how it works. The operations within the nuclear industry are very different than many other industries, you know, that exist. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission understands how this industry works. It is the industry that it regulates, but it can't expect the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Fauci, to understand the implications of this pandemic for the industry that it regulates. So one of the particularities of the nuclear power industry is the way that it operates with its fuel supply and its maintenance schedules. Nuclear power plants these days typically operate on what they call a refueling cycle of 18 to 24 months. So every 18 to 24 months, you know, every reactor in the country has to shut down for a few weeks, potentially up to 2 months, to what they call refuel, which is where they take about a third of the nuclear fuel out of the reactor core and move it into a vent or a radiated fuel pool, and then put in a batch of about a third of the reactor core's worth of fresh fuel, which is a big job on its own. But because the industry also wants to minimize the amount of time that it shuts down reactors to do maintenance, what the industry has taken to doing increasingly over the last 25 years is packing as much regular maintenance and inspections into these refueling outages as possible. So now what you have happening is these operators that are running on, you know, many cases, very thin profit margins, trying to schedule these refueling outages to do not just the refueling, but potentially hundreds of other maintenance jobs and inspections into as small a period of time as they can. And so what they've moved to is this model where they have sort of an itinerant workforce of contractors that rotate from reactor site to reactor site during the spring and fall to work these refueling outages. And so you have potentially up to 1,000 workers, temporary workers, that go to a reactor site for a few days, you know, a few weeks to complete these hundreds of jobs that need to get done. And so what they do is, you know, starting in about February each year, there's this rotating group of workers that work for many different contractors, you know, that don't work for the same company. Many of them are independent contractors themselves. And they'll move from reactor site to reactor site to help with these refueling outages. And so what we had happen this year was the refueling outage season in the spring involved the refueling of about 30 reactors across the country, starting in February, where you had workers showing up, say, at the Vogtle 1 reactor in Georgia, which is another issue, working that refueling outage for 2 or 3 weeks, and then moving on to the Sequoia reactor in Tennessee and working that refueling outage there. And you had the same thing happening in the Northeast and the Midwest and in the Western U.S. with workers that were potentially picking up the virus at one site because they're working in close quarters with hundreds of other workers and with no testing and no protective gear and no social distancing. And then while the pandemic was ramping up across the country, they were moving from reactor site to reactor site in these rural communities without any tracking or any monitoring of what was happening with these infection rates. All the while, in some communities, with local officials complaining about the lack of protection that the nuclear companies were taking about all this, to where at the end of this refueling season, you get to Fermi, which is one of the last reactors to refuel, and all of a sudden, Fermi can't complete the refueling of its reactor because it can't complete the essential maintenance jobs that needed to be done in order to bring the reactor back online because 15% of its workforce was infected with coronavirus. And so what we saw happen over the course of the spring is that the industry's inaction and NRC's negligence has allowed infection rates to be building up within the nuclear workforce over the last few months. And this cycle is all set to repeat in the fall when 24 or 25 more reactors are going to shut down for refueling again. This really can't continue to go on, especially as we're seeing now with the limited amount of reopenings of states that have been happening over the last few weeks, the infection rates are already starting to skyrocket again. In the nuclear industry, just like with the meatpacking plants that were talked about, you know, a month ago, the nuclear industry can be a vector for infection within communities and certainly within its own workforce.
That leads us to the letter that came out from NIRS. But also had a long list of groups and individuals who were signatories. What was the thinking behind the first letter that was sent out on April 22nd?
We saw this crisis developing within the nuclear industry for the first several weeks. And so we coordinated with ultimately about 85 other organizations around the country and to draft a letter to the White House calling for a coordinated interagency federal response to get the impact of the coronavirus within the nuclear industry under control. And so we had six specific asks of the vice president and the other federal agencies that needed to be involved in this, which included convening, first of all, a COVID-19 nuclear task force to develop comprehensive plans and protective measures for workers and reactor operations, to postpone refueling and decommissioning operations at reactor sites, at least until these protocols were put in place, to protect workers and their communities, to provide an immediate reevaluation of NRC's decision to increase the overtime limits for workers at the reactor sites. You know, could cause them to get even more fatigued and more vulnerable to infection. We called upon NRC and the Federal Emergency Management Agency to do what are actually required reviews of emergency response plans anytime there is a natural disaster or a pandemic that could affect emergency preparedness. We also asked the NRC to subject all requests from nuclear plant owners to postpone or exempt them from inspections and maintenance, to do not just a safety analysis of those requests, but to do a cumulative risk assessment of what the total number of exemptions could mean in terms of the impact on nuclear safety. Ironically, NRC has been reviewing each of these exemption requests as though it were an isolated thing, when in fact operators are submitting potentially a dozen such requests at one time. And then we also asked for a comprehensive assessment of which reactors in the country are actually necessary to keep the local electric grid operational, to keep the lights on, so to speak. The industry has been claiming that it has to get these reactors refueled and keep them online in order to keep the lights on. And in fact, in most of the country, there's such a surplus of electricity supply built into the system that there's been no demonstration that any of the nuclear reactors in the country is actually needed to stay online under these pandemic conditions in order to keep the lights on.
How widely was this letter sent out? You mentioned it was sent to the White House, to Vice President Pence, because he's the head of the COVID response, supposedly. Mm-hmm. How much further did it go? Who were you targeting?
It's been reported in the industry trade press a number of times. We also had thousands of people across the country notify their Congress members and senators that we issued this letter and made these demands to the White House. So in fact, just about every Congress member and senator has been notified of this, about what needs to be done and what the problems are.
What's the response been from the nuclear side of things?
The Vice President's office, the White House, hasn't issued any response to our letter at all. But what did happen about 3 weeks ago was that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a response to our letter to the White House, essentially denying that there were any problems and repeating the same claims that they were making publicly prior to our letter, that they had the situation under control. But it was really a page and a half sort of pro forma letter that just repeated the same talking points that they had made before and didn't actually address any of the concerns that we had identified.
Was there any outreach either to nuclear workers or their unions to also sign on to the letter?
We did not do that. I mean, we've had organizations that we work with, some of the grassroots groups that signed on to the letter are based in reactor communities and had some anecdotal reports from workers of their concerns on what was happening. But what we saw happen throughout this episode so far is that the workers are under so much pressure from their employers to not speak out, that both the unions and the workers have not advocated publicly for more safety. And it's been understandable, given what we've seen happen, that they haven't spoken out publicly. For instance, there was some public reporting about workers' concerns in Pennsylvania when the Limerick nuclear power plant was refueling. The workers said that essentially when they approached Exelon, the plant owner, about it, Exelon said, well, you can stay home if you're concerned about the virus, but we're not going to pay you. And so, especially for the refueling outage workers, you know, these guys are just contractors. They don't get sick leave pay, and they don't get unemployment insurance if they don't take the job that's offered to them. And so it's really been a period of fear for workers, on the one hand of the virus, and on the other hand of losing their jobs if they speak out about it. And so it's really incumbent upon our local officials and our federal officials to advocate for the workers and for these communities.
So with this minimal to virtually non-existent response that you got to the first letter, tell us how the second letter came about and what changed within it.
We issued a follow-up letter to the White House this week, sent on Monday. You know, we felt that it was actually really important to respond to what the NRC said to the vice president, to expose the inaccuracies of the way that the NRC was representing itself, but also to update the vice president on the extent of the problems within the industry. One of the things that we did was refer to the actual numbers of infections that have been reported in the industry. So I mentioned the 200 to 300 cases of infection at the Fermi reactor in Michigan. We have reports from in April at the Grand Gulf reactor in Mississippi, which is in the poorest county in Mississippi, which is the poorest state in the country, where there were 89 positive cases of COVID reported at Grand Gulf in April. And this, so it's now been a month and a half, and who knows what's happening now. At the Limerick reactor in Pennsylvania, there were 1.40 workers in quarantine awaiting the results of tests and to check their health. At the Millstone reactors in Connecticut, the Connecticut Coalition Against Millstone submitted a Freedom of Information request to the state, found that there were, by April 24th, there were 11 cases, including three control room operators at Millstone. And then at the Plant Vogel construction site, where they're building the first two reactors to be built in the U.S. in the last 30 years, there have now been over 230 reported cases of COVID-19 or coronavirus infections. That's with a workforce of over 9,000 workers. So, like I said, the rates of infection at the places where we have at least some anecdotal numbers are well in excess of the general population.
So now the second letter has gone out. What, if any, response do you reasonably expect to get as a result?
The Trump administration has shown that it wants to deregulate every industry, right? We've seen them backing off on enforcement of regulations at power plants and other environmental regulations. So the approach they're taking with the nuclear industry right now is typical of the way this administration operates. So I think it's ultimately going to be pressure coming from our state and local and congressional representatives that's going to have to pressure the White House into taking action. And I think the reality is, you know, the one thing that this administration responds to, if it responds to anything, is political pressure from the president's base. And, you know, I think that we need to mobilize our state and local officials and our congressional representatives to apply that pressure, and, you know, as much as possible.
That brings us to something that I've been mulling over a lot lately. And that's the fact, in light of the number of major protests that have been taking place around this country, and that is that people who oppose nuclear tend to be very polite. We write letters, we petition, we have meetings, we post on social media, and nothing or very little, only superficial things seem to change. If we were to stop being so polite and perhaps step outside the box, color outside the lines, pick the cliche of your choice here, what might that look like? And how might we get that started?
Well, I think we've been seeing the impact of protests recently. The protests that have been happening over the killing of George Floyd and systemic institutional racism have showed us the power of protest, right? I mean, it's been remarkable, both the level of commitment and passion that has been mobilized in the midst of this pandemic. You know, I know for myself, a few weeks ago, you know, the only people out protesting were these, you know, right-wing militiamen and other people that were rejecting the stay-at-home orders for the pandemic. And I think we were all starting to feel a little freaked out that those people were the ones getting attention. And we've seen what can happen with mass protest for racial and economic and social justice. And that is really what this situation with the nuclear industry is about. Workers' health and safety is being sacrificed for the profit of these corporations. The health and safety of the communities where nuclear power plants are located is being sacrificed for these corporations that are based in big cities. And effectively, the public health and safety of all of us is being put at risk by the degradation of safety standards that the NRC is allowing to happen, both by allowing its workers to get sick, but also by allowing the industry to get away with not doing maintenance and inspections that are important to protecting against a nuclear meltdown.
Admittedly, the demonstrations that are going on now for racial equality, that are protesting George Floyd's horrific death and so many other issues involving racism, including racism against Native Americans, all of that seems to be key, horrific evidence of that abuse. Nuclear radioactivity is invisible, and it seems that the only thing that sparked a strong movement against nuclear in this country was when the accident happened at Three Mile Island. It was an accident. It was human error. There are a lot of things it could be called, but it did spark massive pushback, massive protest, and significantly scaled down how many nuclear reactors were going to be built at that time. Will it really take, in your estimation, another accident along the lines of Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima, or something else that will invent itself along the way to spark people to an awareness of the dangers of nuclear and perhaps mobilize them to take to the streets in the same way?
I'm not even sure that that would happen. I mean, I think the reality is that, as we've seen with the protests for, you know, for racial justice, it's taken years of organizing. Grassroots organizing, community-based organizing, for the public awareness and the level of determination to take this issue on to erupt in this moment. It seems like it's the killing of George Floyd that motivated or inspired this whole moment of protest. But this has been a movement that's been organizing and building, doing that work for at least since 2013, after the killing of Trayvon Martin. And so I think that what we're seeing now is actually the result of grassroots organizing rather than just some precipitous, horrible event. And I think what you see in relation to the nuclear issue is that after Fukushima, which, you know, was the meltdown and explosion of three reactors that were designed and built by the U.S. and dozens of the same types of reactors operating here, you know, we didn't have some eruption of public resistance powerful enough to shut down the nuclear industry. I think it's actually going to ultimately take organizing with a real commitment to racial and social and economic justice to be able to move the needle on environmental issues, whether it's nuclear power or climate change or other things. So that's, I think, where we're really at. And I think that's really what the effort around the COVID-19 outbreak in the nuclear industry is providing a basis for, is for raising awareness of our local and state officials of both this real thing that's happening that's affecting the health and safety of communities and workers, but also that exposes the level of negligence that's going on in the regulation of the nuclear power industry.
If listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat wanted to get involved in grassroots organizing and would want to support the points that you make in your letter and help push that forward, what might that look like? What would you want them to do?
I think the easiest thing, first of all, is to get in touch with NIRS, Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Our website address is nirs.org. We can help you find a local group in your area that is actually working on this issue and get plugged into what they're doing. What we're encouraging groups at the state and local level across the country to do right now is to use the letters that we've sent to the White House to put those in front of your own state and local officials and congressional delegation and start pressing them for action on this. That's really what it's going to take to move them on this particular issue. I think that the main thing that I would say is that if you're concerned about this issue, get in touch with NIRS and we can help you get plugged in, you know, with grassroots organizing that's happening in your part of the country.
NIRS has always been terrific with grassroots organizing, and we will do what we can to help you get the word out. Anything else you'd like to add at this time?
This has been a really great discussion. I appreciate the time and the opportunity.
Thank you. Tim Judson, you and NIRS are doing terrific work helping us to organize, getting the word out, reaching out to our officials, and creating a model for what it is that we can and we need to be doing as we care about this issue and want to work it forward. And I want to wish you all the best. Stay well. Stay healthy, stay safe, and thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. Keep up the great work.
Tim Judson. As so often happens with my guests, during some chit-chat after the interview, we touched upon things that weren't covered during our talk. Here's what Tim said when the formal interview was over, but fortunately, Zoom was still recording.
Well, one of the issues, right, is that ionizing radiation is so dangerous that just in order to get away with operating the nuclear power industry, they had to incorporate so many layers of protection to minimize the amount of radiation that gets released to the environment as much as they can, that they've been able to create the impression that it's all under control. There's millions of curies of radiation in all of these reactor fuel pools. A relatively little percentage of that actually gets out. But it's still causing epidemics of disease in the communities that live near them. But because it's not a catastrophic amount of radiation that's getting released, it creates this sort of illusion that they're doing a good job of not contaminating the environment. And I think that it's really hard to visually create a different understanding of what's going on. I mean, my sense is that the more that we've been working in sort of intersection with the climate action and climate justice movements the last few years, it's become pretty obvious to me that we're actually pretty well aligned with where the majority of the climate justice movement is. There, this impression that there's a lot of acceptance of nuclear power is really within kind of the mainstream big green environmental organizations. The groups that are frontline communities and experiencing real environmental impact and climate impacts, they get it that nuclear power is a bad idea. It's also that we're a lot of times talking to the wrong people. We're talking to people that we can't convince that this thing is wrong. And we actually need to be talking to different people. That's a lot of what I think is important about the work that you're doing, is that it gives us a way through media of getting information to people that actually don't know it. That's really where I see NIRS's work in the future, is we've got a grassroots movement that we need to support and provide as much resources as we can to. But we also need to be reaching out beyond that base to, you know, whole new communities and movements to get them engaged.
Tim Judson, Executive Director of NIRS. We'll have a link up to their website, NIRS.org, on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 469. We'll also have links to the two letters sent by NIRS and more than 80 other organizations to Vice President Mike Pence and the Coronavirus Task Force. They will be available there for you to forward to your own senators and representatives and anybody else in government you can think of. We'll have this week's other featured interview in just a moment. But first, there is no end to the COVID nuclear connection. As you just heard from Tim Judson, the nuclear industry continues to take COVID-19 risks with the health and safety of its workers, which puts all of us at risk of facing a nuclear accident as well. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission continues to hide COVID statistics at nuclear sites because, hey, if we don't have the numbers, we can't prove anything. That is exactly why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We look at the nuclear aspect of our world every week, and especially now with the coronavirus wrecking havoc. You're not going to be getting this information from mainstream media. They don't have the time or the interest or the attention. Nuclear Hot Seat is the only place you can count on to continue to report on the ongoing, evolving nuclear truth about the COVID nuclear connection, while not dropping the ball on other nuclear stories around the world. But I've got to be honest, since COVID hit, things have been difficult, and I need your help to keep the show going. The fees for the tools necessary to produce, host, post, and disseminate each episode do not go away. So to keep Nuclear Hot Seat going as we launch into our 10th year, now more than ever, we need your help. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to help us with a donation of any size. And to send a monthly $5, same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S., COVID closures notwithstanding, click on the big green donate button. Please do what you can now, and know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's second featured interview. When it comes to the international implications of the U.S. backing out of recent nuclear treaties and opening up production of uranium mining and nuclear weapons production, Robert Alvarez is my source of choice to get a real read on the situation. Bob is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he is currently focused on nuclear disarmament, environmental and energy policies. Between 1993 and 1999, Bob served as senior policy advisor to the Secretary and Deputy Assistant Secretary for National Security and the Environment in the Clinton administration. While at DOE, he coordinated the effort to enact nuclear worker compensation legislation. In 1994 and 95, Bob led teams in North Korea to establish control of nuclear weapons materials. Along with his late wife, attorney Kitty Tucker, he helped organize a successful lawsuit on behalf of the family of Karen Silkwood, the nuclear worker and active union member who was killed under mysterious circumstances in 1974. He is currently writing his memoir, and if you've been following him on Facebook, you've been able to read tantalizing glimpses of his stories. I spoke with Bob Alvarez on Friday, May 29, 2020.
Bob Alvarez, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me.
Bob, there has been so much happening nuclear-wise from this administration in the last several months that it's hard to know where to begin. There have been an ever-increasing number of instances where the government, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the nuclear industry seems to be rushing to turn back the nuclear clock to the days before there were any controls, and that the arms race was something that dominated our world and our nightmares. From your perspective, what, if any, overall pattern do you see to what's going on?
Well, in terms of nuclear energy, commercial nuclear power, I see that the administration is trying to stave off collapse of the commercial nuclear power industry. There are more and more reactors being retired because they simply cannot compete economically, and they're turning into giant radioactive waste management complexes. And with respect to uranium mining, the United States stopped buying uranium for its strategic reserve in 1970, and now they want to resume purchasing uranium for strategic purposes. This has more to do with bailing out a couple failing uranium mining businesses in the United States because the world is awash in uranium. There's more uranium around than we know what to do with. The United States is sitting on a huge stockpile of uranium as it is. And if it were to let it out, it would kill the uranium mining industry in this country. So that's one fact. The other thing about expanded plutonium production, that's true. They're trying to ram through, which is very consistent with this administration, to ignore any environmental safeguards. And so that is what I find to be most worrisome. We really don't need any more new nuclear weapons. We need to get rid of many more than we have. And the United States is not been engaging in any meaningful withdrawal of nuclear weapons since the Obama administration and the G.W. Bush administration. We have a drastically oversized nuclear arsenal that is very expensive to maintain, very complicated to keep going, and it's costing a small fortune to keep together. Now, with respect to radioactive waste management, the Trump administration is pushing very hard to try to establish a centralized interim storage facility. But in order to do that, they have to change the law. A lot of things that Trump is pushing for require congressional approval. A lot of it's tied up in his budget, and the major aspects of his budget is considered dead on arrival right now. So there's a lot of arm-waving going on, but it's still worrisome.
To quote Dr. Helen Caldicott, Trump and his so-called advisors want to destroy every arms control deal that has ever come down the pike. Last year, the administration pulled out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty, which has been in place since 1988, and now it is threatening not to renew the Open Skies Treaty, which has been in place since 2002. What does the Open Skies Treaty do, and what would it mean to no longer have that in addition to not having the INF Treaty in place? What would that do to our security in the world?
Well, it allows, the Open Skies Treaty allows the U.S. and Russia to engage non-military overflights over their respective countries. And that is a form of verification. And it's worked for quite a while. But what Trump is doing is pandering to the hard right. He's basically doing what is very consistent with his behavior. He doesn't care about the majority of Americans. He cares about that slim minority of ultra-right wingers who don't believe in any form of arms control, and he's pushing towards that. Now, he can vitiate this treaty, but I think what's happening is that he's making the world a more dangerous place.
I'm someone who certainly remembers what it was like to grow up in the 50s with the threat of nuclear bombs and nuclear war everywhere, and it was a low-level existential terror that invaded our lives every day. And it seems that the steps that he is taking are going to return us to those kind of times.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think we're at that. We're living in that stage in history. I think what he's doing is propping up a failing industry, and he's doing everything he can to keep it going. The nuclear weapons program has been in a stage of collapse for decades. We haven't made any new nuclear weapons since 1989. So now there's a desperate quest to resume weapons production, which won't happen even under the best of circumstances until well into the next decade. So there's a lot of pushing going on, but I'm not worried about the imminent danger of a nuclear war. What I'm more concerned about is life in an armed nuclear crowd in this world, and him sending a bad example for others to follow, not doing anything to stop other countries such as Saudi Arabia from acquiring nuclear weapons and leading to a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. And he's doing absolutely nothing to really stem the proliferation of nuclear weapons in North Korea and East Asia. What concerns me more about the North Korean situation is whether Japan will get sick and tired and develop their own nuclear weapons, which is a very dangerous situation for the world.
Why do you say you don't think it's going to happen anytime soon?
Well, I don't think we're on area trigger alert. We don't have that kind of situation where we're going to set off a nuke in Russia and Russia's going to do the same. There's a lot of saber rattling going on. There's a lot of effort to keep these large nuclear infrastructures afloat, but they're proving to be very expensive and complicated. And so in order to maintain them, you have to rattle your sabers. But I think the days of global nuclear massive retaliation are well over.
We've learned in the last week that Trump, or the Trump administration, is considering the first new U.S. nuclear test since 1992. And his arms control negotiator, and that seems to be an overly optimistic title because this man doesn't seem to want to negotiate anything, Marshall Billingsley, has been quoted as threatening to spend adversaries into oblivion, that's a quote, in a new nuclear arms race. How much saber rattling is this, and how much do you think there's possible follow through on it?
I think, quite frankly, I think Trump is averse to having a nuclear war. I think there's a lot of inflated rhetoric going on. And I think that these kinds of comments are meant to exercise leverage over China. I mean, the idea of engaging in a belligerent act and exploding a nuclear weapon in order to get China to agree to talk about arms control is a rather blunderbuss approach, and it's not going to work. And shooting off a nuclear test is not like exploding a grenade. You can't do it overnight, despite what they claim. This is a very, very... We haven't tested a live nuke for 28 years. Most of the people who had any real life experience exploding nuclear weapons are either dead or long gone. So this is not going to be a quick kind of event that they claim it will be. Now, what worries me more about this is not, as I said, not about the threat of sending an adversary into nuclear oblivion, but rather setting an example that would allow countries like Pakistan, Japan, and others, Saudi Arabia, to develop their own nuclear weapons. That's what worries me more.
How dangerous is it that we have been, apparently, sending nuclear technology or sharing information about nuclear technology with Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think it's a gross violation of law. And the Congress has been, especially the Senate, has been entirely too supplicant to this. I think that's what worries me more about these guys, that they're going to stimulate the global spread of nuclear weapons, which is, there'll be a time when it'll be outside of our control.
So there is a stockpile of uranium, and there's really no need for uranium mining, even though there have been limits taken off of uranium mining in places like the Grand Canyon, where it's going to be allowed in the watershed of Grand Canyon, impacting the Havasupai people and potentially impacting Navajo Nation as well.
Well, I think that, first of all, the uranium mining industry is in a world depression. We have two uranium mining businesses that are about to go out of business, and that's the end of it. We have no capacity to enrich uranium in this country other than from a foreign company. So I think my attitude about this is that they can do whatever they want and wave their arms and try to make it easier for uranium mining. But the problem is nobody wants to buy it. And so Trump is trying to step in using the budget to buy the uranium to bail out a couple uranium mining businesses in Utah and Wyoming in order to get votes.
What about the current moves that have taken place very recently, where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has allowed to move forward the so-called interim high-level nuclear waste dumps in New Mexico and also in West Texas?
Well, I think that the administration is seeking to establish an interim storage site as an alternative to Yucca Mountain. I think Yucca Mountain is not going to be on the table because of the Electoral College votes. But in order for them to successfully establish an interim storage site, they have to change the law. The law right now, as written, requires reactor operators to pay out of their own pockets all the other activities other than that leading to an opening of a geologic repository. So if they're going to build an interim storage site, all those activities involving predisposal, that is to say, emplacement of spent fuel and dry storage, transport, storage at a selected site, it's all going to come out of their pockets. And the license, if you look at the license applications that have been filed by Waste Control Specialists and Holtec, they presume the government's going to do this. But this requires a change in the law, and I'm not sure Congress is going to go along with that.
What would the change in law consist of?
Well, you'd have to amend the 1982 Nuclear Waste Policy Act, which basically says that the owners of these, that the government will only assume title of the spent fuel once the stuff goes through the gate of an open repository. Other than that, the reactor operators must bear all the other expenses. So that has to change.
So the push to open up these so-called interim storage facilities, which I say interim because Yucca Mountain is no more than a fiction. It's a hole in the ground, it's a tunnel, and it's got a few embellishments in there, but it really is in no position to be a permanent repository.
Well, it also means a potential presidential loss in the election because of Electoral College votes. So they don't want to mess with that. Most of these utilities are operating in a deregulated environment, which means they don't have a captive rate base. So they have to pay for this stuff out of their own pockets. And so they're not going to do that unless Uncle Sam comes and bails them out and assumes title over the spent fuel. And that's the big rub.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that a lot of this is noise that's coming out of Washington, D.C. and the current administration that is looking to help Trump win the election.
It's pro-nuclear bluster, except it has some very deadly consequences, especially when you take it in the international arena. When you start to shred arms control agreements and start to basically openly share weapons technology with countries you regret having to have these bombs. That's where the danger lies.
Given how recently so much of this has been happening, Do you think that there is any aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic and the fact that that is absorbing so much of the national, if not international, attention has some underlying impact on this nuclear messaging?
Oh, I don't know about nuclear messaging. It has a profound economic impact. And so the nuclear industry is not immune from the economic blows that we're suffering as a result of this pandemic. They're in deep water and deep doo-doo as the rest of us are. Now, the other thing that's happened is the demand for energy has gone way down because the economy is in the tank. So all these things are being affected. Now, adding to that is a pandemic itself and what it means in terms of having a capable staff that's not sick and able to go to work and not having any protections provided by OSHA. These are the things that could prove to be very bad and very dangerous for us.
Does OSHA have any say over conditions at, say, a nuclear reactor, where we've been hearing so many cases of COVID positives showing up, and yet the hours that nuclear engineers are being allowed, quote-unquote allowed, if not forced to work, are extended, and the number of days without a break are being extended as well?
Well, OSHA does have the jurisdiction, except they've been locked into the doghouse. They're not allowed out, and so those workers have no OSHA protections, just like the meatpacking plants.
The Department of Energy is also rushing to build what they call advanced new nuclear reactors, even as we know that renewables exist that could eliminate the distorted priorities that are putting nuclear funding ahead of solar, wind, and other genuine renewables. Is that also just part of this extension of let's pander to the base?
Well, there's a lot of that going on, but you have to understand that the Department of Energy, roughly two-thirds of its budget is dedicated to nuclear activities to begin with, even before Trump took office. So the small modular reactor and these other new reactor designs are nothing more but R&D hobby horses. I like to call them PowerPoint reactors because they are always promising something in the near future, but they never tend to happen. Now, not only do you need reactors of that kind to operate, which they've not been able to demonstrate after 10 years of promising them. But you need an infrastructure to support it. An infrastructure provides a specific type of fuel it uses and the kind of expertise. And these are things that just don't happen overnight, but you build a reactor and turn on a switch. So a lot of this is R&D money for what I call R&D hobby horses.
It struck me that one of the reasons that people are not more aware of or afraid of or concerned about nuclear energy and all the other aspects of the waste is that they do not understand what radioactivity is, the fact that it comes from every nuclear device that is out there and uranium mining and all the rest, and what it does long range to the human body. Have you found that the lack of understanding of radioactivity is part of what stops people from standing up against nuclear?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I do know this, is that when you start to shut down a reactor, people start to ask, what are we going to be stuck with? And what are we going to be left holding the bag? And when these reactors shut down, they leave behind some of the largest concentrations of artificial radioactivity on the planet with no credible disposition. And I think this is going to be very worrisome for the nuclear industry because there's going to be a new wave of opposition to nuclear power for that reason. I think that there are a lot of details I can get into, but one of them has to do with the spent fuel that's being generated at nuclear power plants. It's basically they've been doubling the irradiation time, which makes it much more hotter, both radioactively speaking and thermally. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission nor the Department of Energy have any technical basis to understand how long this stuff will hold up over time in storage. And we're taking a big gamble about that. We're going to have to repackage a lot of these wastes, and someone's going to have to pay for it. We're going to be looking at a lot of indefinite storage of this stuff at sites going into the next century.
Can you foresee any way out of this nuclear madness that we have become stuck in?
Well, we have to transition. The paradigm, in a way, is transitioning, whether we like it or not, from one of growth to one of stewardship. And we have to think about how do we take care of this stuff over long periods of time, and how do we deal with this, and who pays for it, and what are the consequences of it. And that's the stuff that we haven't dealt with. We don't have a sort of a roadmap that tells us what are the challenges. What are the balloon mortgage payments that we have to pay for having our romance with the atom? But we made no mistake, we're at the end of an era where nuclear growth is no longer valid, and we're left holding the bag with large amounts of radioactive waste with no credible disposal or storage plans.
And the stuff is radioactive and dangerous for...
Well, it spans the epoch defining the presence of human civilization. So that's what we have to think about. These are very long periods of time. And so we've got to think about more than beyond 300 years.
Bob, for those of us who care deeply about this issue and are not being distracted by COVID or any of the other issues that are out there, but really focusing in on nuclear, what, if anything, do you think would be our next steps in terms of working and pushing to turn this around? Or is it possible?
Well, as I said, we need to start to focus our attention on the fact that we're going to be stuck with a lot of this long-lived dangerous material for a long time, and it isn't going to be moving anywhere. And we have to start to come to terms with that reality. The other thing is that we have to basically oust this president from office in order to save the country from being amidst a nuclear-armed crowd.
Bob, thank you for your insights and your expertise and for taking the time to be my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
That was Bob Alvarez, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he is currently focused on nuclear disarmament, environmental, and energy policies. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, June 16, 2020. A big shout-out to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. If you haven't already done so, 2 things you can do to help us out. First, go to the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook page, like it, share it, make a comment on a post. Then go to nuclearhotseat.com and in the yellow opt-in box, sign on to our database. Give your first name, your email address. I promise we don't bug you. We just get the information to you every week as it posts. That way you never lose a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates on nuclear issues around the world, go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the big red and the big green buttons, and you know what to do. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but hey, fair use is allowed. All you have to do is provide proper attribution. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with the date that it's over, because once it starts, it's never over. That's it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV. Thank you.